If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Tuesday, September the 17th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Hoover Institution's Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Research Fellow. My guest today in our studio here in Hoover's Washington, D.C. office, about 2 miles from Capitol Hill, is Congressman Gary Palmer. Congressman Palmer represents Alabama's 6th Congressional District, the north-central part of the state between Montgomery and Huntsville. Last November, he was chosen by his GOP colleagues to chair the House Republican Policy Committee. And if you go back and look at past lists of the chairman of that committee, you'll find one Richard Cheney, Dick Cheney, who chaired it from 1981 to 1987. This is impressive that Congressman Palmer is in his third term. Did I get that right? His third term. And he is now the 4th-ranking member of the House Republican leadership. Congressman Palmer, thanks for coming down and doing the show today.
Glad to be here, Bill. And I know we're a big fan of Hoover.
Thank you. I know you're tight on time because you're off to see the vice president after this, right?
Yeah, we've got a meeting to talk about USMCA, the trade agreement with Mexico and Canada, which is absolutely critical. And I'm hoping that we'll be able to get that ratified soon.
Very good. So we were talking before we came on the air of a little clash that we have, and that I have a South Carolina family. They all moved to South Carolina. That's why I have the Yankee accent, not a Southern accent. But they're in South Carolina. One niece went to Clemson. The other one married a Clemson boy. And they are just locked into Clemson football, as locked in as can be. I have a grandnephew. His third word after mom and dad was paw. So that's that's the culture going on there. But you are not a Clemson guy. You are a Crimson Tide guy. You played football at Alabama, right?
I practiced football at Alabama under a guy named Bear Bryant. And
Paul Bear Bryant, right?
Yeah, one of my one of the best experiences that I had in life. You learned a lot.
Interesting. So what is the carryover from college football into politics?
Well, one of the things is you learn to handle adversity. And I think that it's one of the most valuable lessons that I learned, but I also learned the value of preparation. Coach Bryant, to paraphrase him, would say that everyone has the will to win, but not everyone has the will to prepare to win. Mm-hmm. And I think those who can deal with adversity in a positive way and have the discipline to prepare, they're generally going to do pretty well.
Yeah, let's talk for a minute about the will to win. You were at the House Republican retreat in Baltimore last
week. I
was,
yes.
The president spoke. The vice president spoke. I noticed Pence said two interesting things there that caught my attention. One was he said, quote, let your voice be heard, and the other, quote, put out that positive message. So what is Congressman Palmer, what is the positive House Republican message right now?
Well, I think our message is that on a number of issues, we have the right ideas. On health care, on pre-existing conditions. I actually submitted the amendment back in the spring of 2017 that set up a plan that covered everyone with pre-existing conditions. And not only did that, it brought down premiums for everybody else. What we were setting up were guaranteed benefits pools, and we did it in all 50 states, so the actuaries would be able to write plans on a level playing field, so to speak. Mm-hmm. We've got the right ideas for energy and for shrinking the trade balance. I think we've got the right ideas on immigration and how to deal with this. And we could go down the whole list, but then, I think the simple message is that we have the right ideas for the country to allow people to prosper, do well, mm-hmm. And to get our country back on the right track.
Yeah, I would like to get into a little bit more of that list a little later in the podcast. The president, I don't know if he said that at the retreat or it was during the time of the retreat, but he tweeted that the House GOP should change its committee chair rules. Right now, you have term limits for committee chairs, right?
We do.
Yeah, it's what, 2 terms, 3 terms?
3 terms.
3 terms. Is that the same for the policy committee?
I don't think so. I think it's on the standing committees. Mm-hmm. The policy committees is different from a standing committee because it's an elected position.
Right.
The standing committee chairman are chosen by the steering committee. So it's a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things, obviously, you can go both ways on this idea of term limiting standing committee chairman, in that you lose experience. And you've got arguably from time to time some incredibly talented people in those positions. But at the same time, there's a lot of talent in the Republican Conference. And I tell people this all the time. I serve with some of the most intelligent, accomplished people in the country. And I think it encourages people to work harder if they know that eventually they could reach the level of a committee chairmanship. And you also, I think, keep a good dynamic going. Different ideas and different abilities that come into play when you rotate the chairman. So
you're pro term limits then?
I think it's working for us.
Mm-hmm.
I like the idea of Jim Collins wrote a book called Good to Great, you know, about getting the right people on the bus and get them in the right places. Coach Bryant could have written that book years ago. He understood. He had an incredible ability to evaluate people, take an analysis of what their abilities were, and get them in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
And it was whether it was a player or a coach or anybody else. He had tremendous organizational skills. I think sometimes when you lock people into a position, you tend to hold back great talent. And I tend to think that we need to be in a position where we give other people an opportunity to move up through the ranks. Now, we can make the argument that three terms is too short.
Mm-hmm.
You might make that argument, but I tend to think we ought to keep the term limits.
Should there be term limits for members in general?
You know, I used to be on that bandwagon for term limits, but what a lot of people don't understand is, and I think most of the push is for limiting members of Congress to three terms. Most of the people, and I'd say the vast, vast majority of people who get elected to Congress are very talented, intelligent people. They're very accomplished, but they're accomplished across a broad array of arenas, mm-hmm. that don't readily translate into success in Congress. So what you wind up having is basically career staff making the decisions for the members. And after three terms, I think most members are just getting to a point where they really know how the place operates.
This is where you are right now.
Right.
Right.
But I had an advantage, Bill. I ran a think tank for 25 years and did a lot of work up here, so I knew how the system worked. And I knew that career staff on the standing committees, and a lot of people don't realize this, each member of Congress has his own committee staff, his own personal staff, mm-hmm. with, you know, whatever committee's on, he has a staff member that works with him on that committee. But the committees themselves are permanent committees. They're standing committees. They have permanent staff. And a lot of those people were here before most of us got here, and they'll be here when a lot of us leave. And they tend to run things. And I don't think the term limit crowd accomplishes their objective by rotating people in and out of Congress who, just as they're really learning how to be effective,
right.
They move them out. So I don't know what the answer would be in terms of rotating staff. That,
yeah.
This is not your everyday business that people think, you know, that government ought to run like a business. Well, that's not how it runs, and it's not how it can be run in a large measure.
Let's talk about the think tank background and how it translates to what you're doing now in this regard, Congressman. There's a school of thought that ideas exist in politics to basically serve as blunt weapons. It's a Ted Cruz approach to politics, I think. You take an idea and you essentially bludgeon your opponent with the idea. There's also a school of thought that policy exists sort of like a set of fine instruments next to a surgeon, and you surgically apply policy to needs and priorities in America. It seems to me you're in the latter school, that you see ideas as more of the surgical side of things.
I subscribe to the Margaret Thatcher philosophy that saying that she said you first must win the debate before you can win the vote. And I think you do that through principled persuasion. And I say this with all due modesty, but I've got people who are stridently opposed to my positions on issues. But when they come see me, they'll tell you afterwards that while they don't agree with my positions, they appreciate the fact that I can explain my positions to them, and I do it, for the most part, rather calmly.
So what would be a good example of that?
Well, it could be a number of issues, right to life. It could be climate change. It could be firearms. Socialism. You know, I think you're aware that there's a big move to turn the United States into a socialist country. This whole idea of Medicare for all is a disaster mm-hmm. for the country. And I think we have to explain that without making it personal. When I first ran for Congress, I pulled my campaign staff together and I told them that we will not go negative. This will be a campaign based on ideas and solutions, and that if anyone had a problem with that, now was the time to get off the train. But we were not going to run a negative campaign. We were going to talk to people about where the country is and what we need to do to get it where it needs to be. Mm-hmm. And I think when you go out and bludgeon people, that not only affects your opponents, it affects everybody who's watching, to the point that they might not think I'd invite him into my kitchen for a cup of coffee and a piece of pie. I think we need to be the kind of leaders that inspire confidence, but also create an impression in people that we know what we're talking about and we're good people. But the most important thing I think we need to do is the country is desperate for authentic leadership. They want people who will tell them the truth, but they also want them to be able to tell them how we're going to fix it, not just attack somebody else. And basically you wind up convincing people to vote for you because they dislike you less than they dislike the person you're running against. That's just not the way to do it, I don't think.
So let's go through three ideas in particular, which I think are going to be at the heart of the 2020 election, ideas which are, or policies, I should say, that are very easy for Republicans to criticize Democrats over. And those would be, one, health care. It's very easy to push back and saying you want to socialize medicine and just look at waiting periods in Canada and you're just going to destroy the current system as is and deprive people of the private health insurance that they clearly like. The second congressman would be immigration. You Democrats want to be the party of open borders. We can't operate that way. And then thirdly, guns. Beto O'Rourke says he wants to seize automatic weapons in the United States. He's going to come after your guns. Easy to criticize Democrats on these, but let's go through these one by one. You tell me the Republican position right now on health care.
Well, on health care, what people want is health care security. And that really comes down to choice plus accessibility. And accessibility means access in time. And affordability. And the Republican plan gives people choice. Unlike the previous administration that said, if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor, we want you to have your doctor. We want you to have that choice. If you get in a situation where you have a major a disease or a major accident or something like that, we want you to have access to the doctors you need, to the technology you need, to the drugs you need, in a time frame when you need it. In Canada, you mentioned Canada, the average wait time in metropolitan areas of Canada is about 18 weeks. In rural Canada, the average wait time is 31 weeks. If you've got certain diseases, certain types of cancer, and you've got to wait 30 weeks to see a specialist, that's a death sentence. Mm-hmm. Between 1995 and 2006, there's somewhere between 25,000 and 63,000 Canadian women died waiting for treatment.
Right. Every Republican should link to the Fraser Institute in Canada, which each year puts out a report which explains waiting time for Canadian health care.
Exactly.
Staggering.
Well, that's actually where I got that that information. The benefits of having run a think tank for 25 years, you know where to look for the facts. But and then you add that third component to having choice and accessibility means access and time to affordability. I also think that we need to not only look at cost, we need to look at outcomes. And I'm a big fan of health savings accounts. So And the bill that we passed in the spring of 2017 actually more than doubled the amount that families and individuals could have in their health savings accounts. In my plan, what you don't use would roll over with no tax consequence, and it would roll over year after year. Well, that's an incentive for people to take better care of themselves, to take their medicine like they're supposed to exercise, do the things that their doctor tells them to do, because there's going to be a payoff. When they reach retirement, they could use that money to supplement their Medicare or to pay for long-term care, and there'd never be a tax consequence. So I think when we talk about healthcare reform, people react to incentives. You not only want to bring costs down, bring that cost curve down, but you also want to improve outcomes. And if you improve outcomes, that cost curve will come down. And on the immigration side, we get wrapped around the axle about the wall, and people, my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, the Democrats, want to make it about trying to keep people from coming to the country to have a better life for themselves, when that's really not the issue with the wall. The issue is we don't know who's coming. I was on National Public Radio earlier this year, and they were going after Sarah Huckabee Sanders, about the fact that she had said we'd interdicted over 3,700 people who were trying had connections to terrorist organizations that were trying to get in the country. She made it sound like it was at the southern border, when in fact it was all over the world, ports of entry. And they were making a big deal about it. And the host of the show said there were only six. Well, my point was, is there a quota that liberals think are acceptable for known terrorists entering the country? Mine's zero. It only took 19 to carry out the 9/11 attacks. That is a huge issue for us. We don't know who's coming across the border. On top of that, there were over 68,000 people died from drug overdoses last year. And that's probably underreported by 15% to 20%, because so many families don't want it on the death certificate that their loved one died from a drug overdose. 85% of the fentanyl, the deadliest drug out there, is coming across the southern border. Over 90% of the heroin, those are your two biggest killers.
Right.
Almost half of the African-American overdose deaths are fentanyl-related. We have got to secure the border. We've got to have the money to have the technology there to detect these drugs. We only randomly test vehicles as they come through the ports of entry. And everybody gets lost on funding for the border wall, but that's not just it's not just a wall. It's the technology that we need to deploy. It's 2,000 more canine units at the border. So it's a huge national security issue, and not just about immigration.
Right.
I think eventually we're going to have to answer the question about the people who have been here illegally for years, recognizing the fact that we're not going to deport 12 or 15 million people and come up with a solution that creates a legal pathway without creating resentment among millions of Americans. So we've got to figure out a way for them to get right with the law. And I think we can.
What does your gut tell you, Congressman, when you hear the phrase comprehensive immigration reform? Some people say comprehensive means, okay, you put everything into it and you can therefore get enough votes. Other people say comprehensive means you're going to put a poison pill in it and therefore make it not possible to pass.
That's generally what happens.
Yeah.
My philosophy on things is that we ought to do things in phases. I don't believe in huge bills. You remember when the Democrats passed Obamacare, Nancy Pelosi famously said, we have to pass this bill to find out what's in it.
Right.
And a lot of people made fun of that, but that was actually a truthful statement. And I've made this argument almost since I've been in Congress that if we're going to do big bills, whether it's immigration, health care, taxes, do it in phases. Because when you pass a 2,000-page bill, there's no way that you're going to get everything right. And if you do a one and done and you discover that you've messed up something, the politics of trying to correct it are pretty toxic. So I say do these things in phases. We need to redo our immigration laws. It's ridiculous to have people waiting years to go through the process and costing them thousands of dollars. We need to take another look at our visa programs and that, and then we've got to deal with the people who are here illegally. And if you do these things in phases, and that gives you time to determine if something's working or not working. If it's not working, you correct it or you stop doing it.
And then the third issue, Congressman, guns, which may be the most emotional issue in America right now.
Well, people want to make it, particularly on the left, want to make it all about guns. And as I pointed out, if you look at the homicide statistics from the FBI, there's three or four times as many people killed with bladed instruments as there are with rifles of any kind. And they say, well, they don't carry out mass killings with or mass attacks with a bladed instrument. Well, there have been a few of those actually, but not to the degree, and not, and they don't get the attention that someone with an AR-15 gets. I think that it won't solve the problem. Someone who's determined to carry out a mass killing will carry out a mass killing. The single largest mass homicide in the history of the United States, carried out by an American, so 9/11 doesn't qualify, was Oklahoma City. It was a ride of rental truck filled with nitrogen fertilizer soaked in diesel fuel with a very simple detonation device that only detonated maybe a fourth or third of the contents, and it killed over 160 people. Had the entire truck detonated, it would have leveled the whole city block and hundreds would have died. Someone who's determined to carry out an attack will carry out an attack. I think we've got to do a better job of monitoring what's going on the dark web. I think we've got to do a better job of following up on leads when we get them. A number of these attacks could have been stopped. The other issue is I think, deals with psychotropic drugs. The FDA put out a list a few years ago of drugs that they know could lead to suicide or violence. There are 31 of them. And we've got, according to the CDC, about 6% of all the children in our schools are on some type of psychotropic drug, and they don't do these genetic tests to determine how one drug would affect one child versus another.
Right.
We've got an epidemic in this country of drug overdose deaths and suicides to the degree now that CDC has lowered life expectancy in the United States for 3 years in a row, which is incredible. We're the wealthiest, most advanced nation in the history of the world. So it tells you something about our culture as well. I mean, when I was growing up, and I don't know about where you grew up, but that wasn't an issue. The whole culture has changed, and I think it's not only playing out right in front of us in regard to these rampage attacks and these mass shootings, it's playing out with the overdose deaths and playing out with the suicides. And you try to make it just about one thing, an inanimate object, and you don't deal with the bigger picture, you're not going to solve the problem.
Right. So you are closing in on 5 years in Congress. Next year will be six. Tell me, what have you learned in the time you've been here? Now, you mentioned having worked for a think tank, you already had a sense of how Washington operated, and so you're not exactly a stranger to Capitol Hill, but it is, I imagine, one thing to be on the outside looking in, another thing on the inside, actually dealing with members. What has surprised you about being a member of Congress?
I don't know if I've been surprised by anything. If anything, I'd say it's more surprised at how many people believe everything they read on the Internet.
What?
I mean, I always run into people that think that we get all these benefits and like lifetime salary after one term. I had one lady who came in to see me, and she was she wasn't in agreement with my policies. She's a Democrat, but she made the statement, you members of Congress, you get all these benefits, you get your full salary for life after one term. And my response was, whoa, 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 ma'am. How stupid do you think I'd have to be if I could get my full salary after one term to do this again? Yeah, that would be the ultimate in term limits. But it's not just that. It's stuff that gets put out I get stuff about my Democrat colleagues that's just totally made up. Mm-hmm. You know, people will send me and say, did you know they're doing this? And to the point that I think that it is an intentional effort to mislead the American people. It's a propaganda effort. I think that said, that if we understand what's going on, then it's incumbent on us to do things like I'm doing right now, talking to your listeners, mm-hmm. and come back with intelligent ideas and be one of the things that surprised me is how many members are unwilling to go home and engage with their local media. I won't say who it was, but literally had someone a few years ago in leadership that told us, don't do that. They'll don't go back and go on local talk radio. They'll turn on you. I haven't found that to be the case. And obviously, I'm from Alabama, but we got some pretty tough media back in Alabama, and they don't all agree. I mean, but I'm willing to go talk to them. And you need to do that, because you need to have the ability to communicate to your constituents, the people who are actually going to vote for you, what you believe and the solutions that you think make the most sense for the country, as opposed to doing just inside the Beltway media that nobody really pays any attention to, mm-hmm. to be brutally honest. And so that's one of the things I'm trying to do through as chairman of the policy committee, is to equip our members so that they can discuss these issues intelligently, and they can put it in their own language. I can't – the guy who's running for Congress in New York or California is not going to talk about the issues the way I do in Alabama. But those core principles will still be the same. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what I'm trying to do, is equip our guys so that when they go back, they can articulate these and they can make it fit their districts.
Right. Now, where do the ideas come from? The ideas come in-house? Is it you and a group of very smart people sitting in a small room like we're in right now cooking up ideas? Are you turning to other members? Are you tapping into think tanks? How do you acquire your ideas?
Well, having been here now for almost 5 years, I've had the opportunity to be in dozens and dozens of hearings, and a lot of the ideas are coming out of hearings, not only from committees that I was on, but from other committees, looking at what's coming out of some of the think tanks. And that's one of the advantages that I have, is that I know where to look for information. And I actually hired a gentleman as the executive director of the policy committee who worked for me in the think tank. He also worked up here on the Hill, but he also worked for a national think tank. So he's got that network as well. And then things that we've worked on in years past, including how to cover pre-existing conditions. That idea actually came for setting up these guaranteed benefits pool. Actually came from Maine. Mm-hmm. The state of Maine had implemented that, and it worked. And I worked with another national think tank, the Foundation for Government Accountability, to put that together. And I think your listeners all realize that the House passed that bill, but it went over the Senate, and John McCain voted no on it.
Right.
But that's not the end of the story. Back in May, the state of Louisiana passed a bill to replace their version of Obamacare with a new health care plan that included this provision for covering pre-existing conditions, which I gave them some input on, but also connected them to this think tank, the Foundation for Government Accountability. And they passed this with a veto-proof margin. That means Republicans and Democrats got together and said, this will work. It's the accumulation of ideas over the years from these various groups that I think puts me in a position, a unique position somewhat, to look for opportunities for application and adaptation. And that's what we're trying to do.
And how does that work within the leadership? So you're the fourth in line, so that means you have the conference chair, you have the whip, and the leader in your group. Do the four of you sit down and talk policy, or do you do policy and bring it to the leadership? How does that dynamic play?
It's usually I bring ideas to the team, mm-hmm. And I'll be bringing some other ideas. I've been actually working with some of the Hoover fellows on another issue about how to pay for infrastructure, and that I'll be bringing that idea to our leadership team as well. But I'm not prepared to discuss it in detail today. So, it's always good to let the team know before you go out public with it.
Exactly. So you're full of ideas, and you're a very thoughtful person, obviously, Congressman. And in theory, there's a chamber for you waiting for you to go to. That's the United States Senate.
Well, I'm way too young for that.
There's a Senate race in Alabama, though, next
there
year.
Is. My attitude is that I want to be where I'm supposed to be, doing what I'm supposed to do. And unless I feel just absolutely compelled to do that, I think I need to stay where I am. And obviously in the Senate, one individual can really have a major impact, more so than in the House. But then again, I am in leadership. And we're going to have a campaign next year, and the focus is going to be on whether or not President Trump can win re-election. I think he can. But there needs to be, I won't say equal, but a tremendous amount of attention paid to the House. I think historically you see that when a president wins re-election, there's a two-year window for really getting anything done.
Right.
And then they truly become lame duck. That two-year window, we have to have the majority of the House if we're going to get some key things done. And I think we can do that. We only need to win 19 more seats to get the majority back. But all revenue bills have to begin in the House. And a lot of what we're trying to do on regulation will begin in the House. So I think that I'm very optimistic that we will be able to get the majority back and that the president will be reelected and that we're going to be able to move some things that I think will really, really help people and help the country get back on the right track.
Right, but here's the challenge again. It's easy to run against Democrats in 2020 and saying, well, for example, next week, Congresswoman Presley, Massachusetts Democrat, she's going to put forward an impeachment resolution against Justice Kavanaugh. So very easy to go out in 2020, especially into those swing districts that voted Democratic in 2018 and say, this is what you got. We need to change this. But you're talking about actually putting ideas. And so again, this gets to the question, Congressman, of what the brand for the Republican Party is going to be in 2020 at the congressional level. We know what Donald Trump's going to run on, but you're running as House Republicans. What two or three things would Republican candidate, let's take a generic Republican candidate, not a candidate in Alabama or California, mm-hmm. but just a generic Republican candidate, and saying, you should elect me to the House because in our first 100 days or in the first year of President Trump, we will do X, Y, and Z. What congressman are X, Y, and Z?
I think the first thing that we need to be talking about is health care. That's going to be the top issue.
Which it is with Democrats, but if you look at polling for Republicans, immigration tends to rank high for Republicans. They reflect the president's rhetoric.
I think the polling that I've seen indicates that health care is going to be, again, going to be the top issue.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, when we were working on the health care bill, not only do we have to address the issue of choice, because people want choice, we've got to address the issue of accessibility, because they want to have access. But they want to be able to afford it. They don't want to go bankrupt trying to save their own life or the life of a loved one. And we can do that. I think the ideas that we're going to bring forward are going to resonate with the American people. I think we can address immigration. And I think we'll be able to address it in detail in a way that makes sense to the American people. And the economy is going to continue to be an issue. The data that I've been looking at, those are going to be the three things that are in the mix all the time. People want to feel secure. At the end of the day, it's about security. They want to be secure in their job, secure in their health care options, and I think they want to feel like the country's secure and that we're not going to be come under an attack from terrorist groups or that we're going to be overrun. And I think we can address that.
And are you thinking of packaging this as, say, another Contract with America or some marketing device like that?
I don't know if we'll do it as a contract with America.
Mm-hmm.
There are plenty of people out there that will want to market this one way or another.
Right.
I think what it is that I honestly think we need to admit the mistakes that we've made in the past. What I said at the end of the day, what I think the country is desperate for is authentic leadership. That's what they got in President Trump. He was outside of every definition that you could come up with of what you would expect in a political candidate. And I think that's what made him appealing to so many people is that he was speaking to to the real concerns of people, and he didn't come across as the same-o. I think I don't think necessarily that we all need to be launching a Twitter storm, but I do think that we need to get out and have more courage and more honesty and absolutely more clarity about what we believe and what we're going to do. And I think trust the American people to make the right decision. I think they will.
Yeah, notice you're not pouring your heart out on Twitter 24/7, are you?
I don't do that. I have a lot of opinions, but I don't think that everybody needs to know every thought that I have. I've learned over time that that's a good policy because sometimes the thoughts I have, I later am very glad that I didn't put that out. So if you don't say it, you don't have to backtrack on it. And it gives you time to be reflective and sit down and have a conversation with somebody like you or some of your colleagues and think, well, that wasn't such a great idea after all.
So you're soon to be three terms in. How long do you want to stay in Washington?
Well, I said I'd serve five terms in the House, and we'll see what happens.
Okay, and you're gonna stick to that five terms.
I think I'm honor bound.
Yeah, you know, the line forms to the rear of the over on the Senate of every senator who said they'll serve only two terms, and then come year 10 or 11, it's, oh, I didn't really mean what I said back then.
Yeah, well, I don't want to spend my life up here, not in the long term anyway. I think from my perspective, people need to be where they're supposed to be, and they need to be doing what they're supposed to be doing. And I think I can be effective. I can still be an asset, whether I'm in office or not. Obviously, once you leave office, you go from making a decision to making a suggestion. But I'll address that when the time comes.
And think you'd want to stay in office if you like ideas and you like putting them into motion? Being a governor is a great job.
Well, there are people talking to me about that, and they're talking to me about the Senate, and there are a few that would like to just see me leave, but they generally don't vote for me anyway.
Well, it looks like you have a good path as long as that Nick Saban guy doesn't run for office.
Well, if Coach Saban were to announce that he was running for office, every Auburn fan in the state would vote for him. Get him out of Alabama.
That is funny. You know, Donald Trump made that comment about he'd walk you down the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot someone to get away with it. Do you think Saban could get away with that in Tuscaloosa?
I doubt it.
You doubt it?
Yeah. We do have some standards. I'll tell you about Coach Saban, though. And obviously I'm biased. I was on the team at Alabama, and I like what he's doing. People need to really look at the process and what he's trying to do. He's not trying to just build great football players. He's trying to build great people. And he brings these recruits in, and he talks about the process and what he's trying to do, and he points out to them that, you know, they're 18 years old. If they're really, really good, they might be there 3 years and get drafted as juniors, so they'll be 21. Right. If they're really, really good, they might play 9 years in the league, so they'll be 30. And then he says, average life expectancy is about 80. What are you going to do with that last 50? And that's what an education is about. And if you look at the graduation rate for Alabama football players, it's in the top five. It's up there with Stanford and Vanderbilt and some of these other schools. So he's really – and I think this is attractive to a lot of parents who's the parents of excellent athletes, is that – they're not just interested in their son going to the University of Alabama and being an All-American football player. They want him to be a person of character and a person who has a future beyond football, because I can tell you, having played the game and seen this happen, one of the best players I ever played with as a freshman got his knee blown out. The guy would undoubtedly been an All-American, but he never played another down. And that was Kelvin Kroom. His brother was Sylvester Kroom, who was an all-conference and great player at Alabama and head coach and coached the Packers, played in the pros. But his brother was an exceptional athlete in one play, and it's over. So that's what Coach Saban, I think, understands, is that there has to be a future beyond the football field.
And okay, final question. I know that you have to run. It is the first week of January in 2021, and you are now sitting in the majority in the House of Representatives, and it is your great honor to introduce H.R. 1, the first bill of that session. What is H.R. 1?
From my perspective, it would be our health care reform bill.
So
I think we owe it to the American people. There is so much angst for people dealing with health care issues. Not only the life and death aspect of it, which puts tremendous pressure on people and creates tremendous anxiety, but the thoughts about how they can pay for it. And I think we need to take that off the table, and I think we can. And Bill, there are things going on in medical research in Alabama, for instance, with Hudson Alpha in Huntsville, Alabama, at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, at Southern Research Institute. We're on the cusp of literally miracle cures. The question is, can people afford it? And I think we're smart enough to figure out a way that the answer to that could be yes. We've got to do some regulatory reform in regard to pharmaceuticals and take care of some issues there as well. But there are unbelievable advances in medicine. And by the way, I know you guys are located at Stanford. The Human Genome Project was located at Stanford, and
right.
It was moved, and it was moved to Huntsville, Alabama. It's now at Hudson Alpha. So I just think people should be encouraged at the direction we're going, and if we get the majority back, I will be urging my leadership colleagues to make that the first thing we do.
Okay. Well, it'll be interesting to see what the future holds for you in the House.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Thank you, Congressman. You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. And in this podcast, the policy avenues being pursued by the House Republican Caucus. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word. Get your friends to have a listen. I also recommend you sign up for Hoover's monthly Pod Blast, which gives you the best of Area 45 Econ Talk, the Classicist Strategica, the Pacific Century Education Exchange, plus fellows' remarks from Hoover events. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for Hoover's Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Hoover fellows your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Congressman Gary Palmer is on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @USRepGaryPalmer. That's @USRepGaryPalmer. He also has a House website, which is palmer.house.gov. You can also find the Republican Policy Committee online as well. It's @RepublicanPolicy.house.gov. Anything else I missed, Congressman?
I think that pretty well covers it, Bill.
Thank you. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, iTunes U, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.